conservative ideology. Moreover, when participants were resurveyed after the election, the researchers learned that those who had encountered a U.S. flag on the prior questionnaire had voted for McCain at a significantly greater rate than the other participants. Finally, and perhaps most remarkably, a full 8 months after the election, participants who had made contact with their flag during the long past survey were still embracing more Republican Party-oriented attitudes, beliefs, and judgments. Could that single exposure really account for such lasting and consequential effects? Results such as these beg for explanation. Explanations, actually, because there's more than one process involved. The first is persuasive in character. Background exposure to the American flag put participants in mind of Republican Party thinking. Indeed, a pilot study done by the researchers showed that in 2008, anyway, Americans reliably made that link between the flag and republicanism. Just as we've seen previously that a background encounter with French music in a shop disposed people temporarily toward French things, such as French wine, and a background encounter with an image of fluffy clouds on a furniture store website made people more disposed temporarily toward soft things, such as comfortable sofas, such an encounter with the American flag made people temporarily more disposed toward Republican Party candidates and positions. So much for the flag's immediate effects. But how can we explain their surprising persistence? The survey researchers think they know. After coming across the American flag and becoming temporarily more inclined toward republicanism, participants were asked to act on that inclination by registering it in the survey, thereby committing to it behaviorally. Their commitment led to an even more committing form of activity when they subsequently voted in the election, which in turn led to a solidified Republican Party orientation when measured 8 months later. This sequence is reminiscent of the outcomes of research examining the effect of a different persuasive experience, happy mood, on a different type of preference, for artwork. After people read a happy story, their temporarily elevated mood caused them to like a painting. But 5 days later, only those who had actively rated it while in that elated state still felt the same way about the painting. Those who had not rated it and therefore had not locked in that evaluation behaviorally showed no special preference for it at all after the happy mood had dissipated. The implication for effective persuasion is plain. Persuasive openers can produce dramatic, immediate shifts in people. But to turn those shifts into durable changes, it's necessary to get commitments to them, usually in the form of related behavior. Not all commitments are equal in this respect, however. The most effective commitments reach into the future by incorporating behaviors that affect one's personal identity. They do so by ensuring that the commitment is undertaken in an active, effortful, and voluntary fashion, because each of these elements communicates deep personal preferences. For instance, if through someone's persuasive maneuver of showing me images of people standing together, I become temporarily inclined toward an inclusive social policy, say, raising the minimum wage for all workers, and I see myself acting on that preference by making a quickly requested financial contribution to the cause, I will become more committed to the idea on the spot. In addition, if the action was both made freely, it was entirely my choice, and difficult or costly to perform, the size of my donation was substantial, I'm even more likely to view it as indicating what I favor as a person. It's this behaviorally influenced self-perception that would anchor and align my later responding on the issue. And it would be so even if the sequence was instigated persuasively by a momentary shift of attention, in this case, to the concept of togetherness. Creating lasting change by queuing up the cues. Back when I was trying to learn everything I could about influence professionals' persuasion practices, I received an invitation in the mail to experience an amazing opportunity to achieve wealth, prosperity, and financial independence beyond your dreams. I was certain it involved some kind of pyramid scheme, which normally would ensure the end of my interest. But because I was curious at the time to learn how its promoters planned to sell the scheme, I called to reserve a place. The most intriguing aspect of the event for me was its location. Although I and about 50 other individuals, ranging from economically interested to desperate, came together on a Saturday morning at a Phoenix restaurant, we didn't stay for long. We were escorted onto an aging, distinctively colored yellow and blue bus for a 2-hour highway drive to Tucson, where, we were told, the educational event would take place. That was a lie. When we got to Tucson, there was no new enlightenment provided. At lunch, a speaker just briefly reviewed the points we'd heard on the bus ride. Why would the program organizers spend good money on such a bewildering journey? By then, I knew. The program information was never envisioned for Tucson. It had always been designed for the bus. I was sure this was true because halfway to Tucson, I'd looked out my window and observed another aging, distinctively colored yellow and blue bus carrying a load of riders from Tucson to Phoenix. That sight supplied an immediate clarifying epiphany. From the start, the organizers had intended to expose us to the details of their wealth program, a pyramid scheme, as I'd suspected, on buses rattling along the road between the two cities. I believe that was the case for a pair of psychologically based reasons. First, it was hard to think hard in that rolling, noisy, bumpy, crowded, emotionally agitating environment, and hard thinking is the chief foe of pyramid sales systems. Second, when people can't deliberate carefully, can't concentrate fully, they are much more likely to respond automatically to whatever decision-making cues are present in the situation. On our bus, the program organizers controlled those cues. They'd been able to fill the space with an array of features that, wherever we looked, set us up to be receptive to their message. Achievement-related posters adorned the walls and ceiling. Wealth-linked slogans were taped to our seatbacks, and success-themed music preceded each new speaker's presentation. Songs from the Rocky movies predominated. Eye of the Tiger was a favorite. The speaker's basic message was always some version of, "You can do it, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it," provided you use the system. This universal assertion was accompanied by a collection of supportive cues. An expensive, beautifully tailored suit worn by one speaker. An $11,000 commission check from this month alone, waved by another. A glowing testimonial letter read by a third from an individual who before starting the program had been just like you folks. By the time we'd returned to Phoenix, 2/3 of us had signed on. Modern life is becoming more and more like that bus hurtling down the highway. Speedy, turbulent, stimulus-saturated, and mobile. As a result, we are all becoming less and less able to think hard and well about what best to do in many situations. Hence, even the most careful-minded of us are increasingly likely to react automatically to the cues for action that exist in those settings. So, given the quickening pace and concentration-disrupting character of today's world, are we all fated to be bozos on this bus? Not if, rather than raging against the invading automaticity, we invite it in but take systematic control of the way it operates on us. We have to become interior designers of our regular living spaces, furnishing them with features that will send us unthinkingly in the directions we most want to go in those spaces. This approach provides another way, besides making immediate, forceful commitments, to arrange for initially formed preferences to guide our future actions. By assuring that we regularly encounter cues that automatically link to and activate those preferences, we can commission the machinery in our behalf. Previous chapters offered some examples of how we might go about it. If you want to write in a way that connects with a particular audience, perhaps you are preparing a report or presentation, surround yourself with cues linked to the group. For instance, typical audience members' faces. If you want to approach a task while possessing a strong achievement orientation, perhaps at work, give yourself contact with images of success, striving, and accomplishment, such as a runner winning a race. If you want to approach a different task while possessing an analytical orientation, perhaps when figuring a budget, give yourself access to images of contemplation, thoughtfulness, and examination. For example, Rodin's The Thinker. And so on. You might even be able to optimize the performance of each of these types of tasks in the same place, on the same computer, by changing the screensaver to show a series of images appropriate to whichever orientation you want to apply to a specific task. If when, then plans provide yet another way to harness the power of associative connections for our long-term advantage. It's something they do by associating desirable goals and actions with cues that we will experience in regularly occurring future situations. If, after my business lunches, the server asks for dessert choices, then I will order mint tea. Or when it's 8 in the morning and I've finished brushing my teeth, then I'll take my prescribed dose of medicine. Although each of these suggested tactics is consistent with research presented earlier in this book, there's another worthy tactic that gets its support from research we haven't yet seen on the role of mere reminders. Persuasive Geographies 2. Who we are is where we are. Whenever I speak to healthcare management groups about the influence process, I'll ask, which people in the system are most difficult to influence? The answer is invariably and emphatically, physicians. On the one hand, this circumstance seems as it should be. To get to their elevated positions in the healthcare hierarchy, doctors endure years of training and practice, including medical school specializations, internships, and residencies, that give them a great deal of information and experience on which to base their choices, making them understandably reluctant to be swayed from those choices. On the other hand, this kind of resistance can be problematic when physicians don't adopt recommendations for changes that would benefit their patients. All of which raises a larger issue. Why do most doctors enter the medical profession in the first place? Is it principally for other-serving or for self-serving reasons? Is it to benefit and relieve the suffering of their patients? Or is it to obtain the considerable authority, respect, status, and income that normally accompany the role? A study done in a U.S. hospital gives us valuable insight into the issues. The researchers, Adam Grant and David Hoffman, noted that even though hand washing is strongly recommended before each patient examination, most physicians wash their hands less than half as often as the guidelines prescribe. What's more, various interventions aimed at reducing the problem have proved ineffective, leaving both doctors and patients at greater risk of infection. Grant and Hoffman thought they could do better just by bringing physicians' attention upon entering an examination room to one of two powerful motivations, concern for themselves or concern for their patients. To channel attention to the self-centered concern, the researchers placed signs above some examination room soap or gel dispensers that read, "Hand hygiene protects you from catching diseases." To channel attention to the patient-centered concern, they placed signs over a different set of dispensers that read, "Hand hygiene protects patients from catching diseases." Despite only a single word of difference, the effect of the two types of signs was dramatically one-sided. The sign that reminded the doctors to protect themselves had no effect on soap and gel use. But the one reminding them to protect their patients increased usage by 45%. These results afford us important information about a pair of related issues. First, although many other kinds of interventions had failed to reduce the problem, simply drawing doctors' initial attention to the connection between hand washing and patient protection was a notable success. Of course, in the previous instances when the doctors hadn't washed their hands, a deep concern for patient welfare was no doubt present in them then too, as was a recognized link between hand washing and patient welfare. What accounts for the difference? In those previous instances, there was nothing there to direct the doctor's attention to the link, to elevate it to top of mind, above the other relevant features of the situation. How the patient looks, what the attending nurse is saying, what the case notes are saying, and so on. All it took was one sign visible as the doctors entered, reminding them of the link, to change their behavior impressively. Plus, it appears from the study's data that we have an answer to the question of what most physicians are really like deep down. They appear to be, one, other-oriented individuals, strongly motivated to enhance the well-being of their patients, and two, not of the sort we'd have to worry would ever serve their own interests at their patient's expense. Although the first of these conclusions seems correct, a study carried out at Carnegie Mellon University casts doubt on the second. It concerned another practice that physicians have been warned jeopardizes their patients' best interests. Doctors are frequently offered gifts from health industry companies, most notably pharmaceutical firms, but also medical equipment manufacturers, in the form of pizza for their office staffs, lunches and dinners for themselves, all expenses paid trips to conferences, research and consulting contracts, and fees for teaching or speaking at meetings, and even for participating in product-related conference calls. The evidence is strong that these gifts and sponsorships influence physicians to return the favors by prescribing or endorsing products that further the welfare of the industry sponsors rather than of their patients. Despite such evidence and accompanying warnings, many continue to accept the patient-compromising bounty of their positions, even while recognizing its problematic implications. What's going on here? How could it be that physicians would act more on behalf of their patients' interests than their own in the hand-washing study, but the reverse seems to apply in the case of gift-taking? Maybe it's that hand-washing is a relatively small-cost act, compared with rejecting industry-sponsored benefits, and within such higher-value choices, self-interest wins out, as it well might in any group of people. Maybe that's true. Doctors are people, after all. But the rule for reciprocation, which states that those who give first are entitled to receive in return, and the findings of the Carnegie Mellon University study offer a less cynical, more textured view. That study of 301 resident physicians in the United States began with a pertinent question. What might cause doctors to become more versus less accepting of industry-sponsored favors? One sample of the physicians was simply asked in an online survey whether and to what extent taking gifts and payments from industry representatives was acceptable to them. In the researchers' analysis, only about one-fifth, 21.7%, found the practice acceptable. But when a second sample was asked the same question, preceded by items inquiring into how much they had sacrificed personally and financially to become MDs, nearly half, 47.5%, thought gift-taking acceptable. Finally, when a third sample was both reminded in the same way of their prior sacrifices and asked whether the resources they'd previously expended justified taking gifts, a clear majority, 60.3%, came to see the practice as acceptable. What should we make of these results? Speaking for myself, I've drawn multiple conclusions, including the heartening one that despite a healthy, unhealthy is probably the better word here, minority who thought gift-taking acceptable, most physicians found it an unworthy choice. However, focusing physicians persuasively on the large inputs they had supplied to the healthcare system made them much more willing to take large returns from it. That result, plus the fact that a reciprocity-based rationale caused the majority to embrace gift-taking, implicates the temporarily surfaced rule for reciprocation as a major culprit here. Lastly, these findings tell me that the answer to the question of whether, as a group, MDs are primarily patient-serving or self-serving is yes. They are each, depending on their attentional focus at the time. That's a conclusion that applies to far more than physicians, whose remarkably elastic preferences serve to illustrate how top-of-mind factors operate on all of us. It's also a conclusion that provides a fitting close to this book. In large measure, who we are, with respect to any choice, is where we are, attentionally, in the moment before the choice. We can be channeled to that privileged moment by choice-relevant cues we haphazardly bump into in our daily settings, or, of greater concern, by the cues a knowing communicator has tactically placed there, or, to much better and lasting effect, by the cues we have stored in those recurring sites to send us consistently in desired directions. In each case, the made moment is persuasive. Whether we are wary of the underlying process, attracted to its potential, or both, we'd be right to acknowledge its considerable power and wise to understand its inner workings.
Persuasion, A Revolutionary Way to Influence and Persuade, was written by Robert Cialdini and read by John Bedford Lloyd, with opening comments read by the author. The mix engineer was Alex Reisdorf. Recording, editing, mastering, and post-production by Kessler Media in Katona, New York. Robert Cialdini was recorded at KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona. The engineer was Silver Rodriguez. The associate producer was Jennifer Lopes. The producer and director was Robert Kessler. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Persuasion, A Revolutionary Way to Influence and Persuade, is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.